writer starts out creating deeply personal stories about growing up on our southern border. Then those stories take on a sharper salience as hatred rears its ugly head in our country.
I can't help but think of Germany at a time when people could have stood up and could have said no to the National Socialist movement that was going on there, and then decided, no, you know what, the economy's good. As long as the economy's good, why should we complain? Yeah, okay, it's unpleasant, but, you know, we're making more money. And I feel like we're almost at that point. And so I feel like we have to speak up. We have to take a stand. And if my book is used as a way to sort of educate people about the situation in the border, I welcome that.
That's playwright and author Octavio Solis. We talk with him about his book of stories about growing up in El Paso, Texas, the son of Mexican migrants. It's called Retablos, Stories from a Life Lived Along the Border. We also talk about the mass shooting in El Paso and the impact it's had on Solis's own family and hometown. Finally, we re-air my 2018 interview with singer-songwriter Don Arbor about his song, Everyone Comes From Somewhere. It's in honor of immigrants. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. And you do know, don't you, that you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our free podcast and weekly newsletter. Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. Octavio Solis is one of America's most prominent Latino playwrights, author of over 20 plays, including Mother Road, currently running at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. Solis recently published his first collection of stories, Retablos. They're based on his own life, growing up the son of Mexican migrants in El Paso, Texas. The stories use memory as a muse to talk about his complicated relationship with his father, the Chicano movement that informed his view of politics at an early age, his estrangement from his brother, so like a border wall itself, and how the border is as much myth as reality, replete, as he writes, with gods and monsters, heroes and fallen angels, troubadours and exiles. Living in a home just a mile from the Rio Grande, Solis was a skinny brown kid on the border, growing up among those who live there and those passing through on their way north. From the first terrible self-awareness of racism, to an innocent game of hide-and-seek, to the discovery of a Mexican girl hiding in the cotton fields, Solis reflects on the moments of trauma and transformation that shaped him into a man. Octavio Solis is the author of more than 20 plays and served as a cultural consultant on Pixar's movie Coco. His book Retablos is published by City Lights Press. Octavio Solis, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, it's my pleasure. My pleasure to be part of this. I'm very happy to speak with you about my book.
It's just a wonderful book, a memoir told in short stories, really. Stories from a Life Lived Along the Border, as the subtitle says. Retablos. First, just tell us, what is a retablo?
A retablo is, I think of them as thank you notes to God. Kind of thank you notes, postcards to the divine. They're done ex voto, after a vow, signifying an event, usually painted on a plate of tin or a beaten license plate by a naive artist to commemorate an event, a calamity, which required a plea to the divine, to God, to a specific saint, to the Virgen de Guadalupe, to come and save them from that. And when they are, they offer this as a kind of thank you to commemorate the event. It's inscribed very, very briefly with a description of the event and then this very specific thank you to whichever divine figure came and offered them solace or offered them salvation or some rescue from this calamity. And the calamity can be as immense as someone possibly dying of cancer or a bus crash or something as mundane as a bee sting on the heel or a dog attacking or the village pig dying, for instance, something like that. But I was struck by them because they seem to me to be very early instances of flash fiction with a graphic design on it as well, graphic picture.
Flash fiction, what is that?
Yes. Yes, flash fiction, a kind of very short, very concise story with a beginning, middle, and end, containing characters, containing a kind of point. It doesn't need to be a moral at the end of it, like a fable, but a story offering a kind of a complex view on the human condition. It can be very deeply personal, or it can be quirky and funny and to be appreciated by everyone, usually. But I found these to be very, these retablos to be very inspiring for me because they sort of seem to be dictating to me the kind of form that these memories that I had should take.
Memories that you say in retablos, memories that verge on the divine. So there is that divine connection in terms of what a retablo is. But why do these memories verge on the divine?
I think it's because there's something miraculous in them. I feel like any time that we undergo an event, if we come out of it somehow changed or altered or smarter or wiser or hit with some kind of epiphany, I feel like that's a miracle. That's a miracle in itself and requires a kind of commemoration in that way. We need to remember those moments, because they changed us and they changed our relationship to the world. And to me, that's really where the divine intersects with the commonplace.
And moments of epiphany can occur in many ways and do occur in many ways in these stories. The one thing that ties them together is that they're almost like stages of the cross in growing up on the border in El Paso in the 1960s and 70s. Tell us a bit about your family, how your family came to El Paso, and you were born there, is that right?
Yes, yes. I was born there in 1958. My mother and father came from Mexico. They came from very different areas, different parts, not too far from each other, but my dad's life was essentially rural, agricultural. He came from a small village called Nasas. And my mom came from a distinctly industrialized city named Torreon in northern Mexico. And they had met each other in Torreon when he finally had left the village to find work and just go to school in Torreon. But they lost contact with each other until by happenstance, they happened to run into each other in Ciudad Juarez. There they met, they started courting. He courted my mom, and then at some point they decided to get married. But according to my grandmother, on the condition that they moved to the United States, because my grandmother wanted her grandchildren to be Americans. She insisted that if they get married, they should move to El Paso. So they crossed the border at the bridge, they walked over, and my mom had papers through my grandmother, but my dad didn't. And my dad didn't think that he needed papers. He thought he could live in El Paso and work in Juarez. He walked daily to Juarez to sell advertisements, ad space, ad time to businesses for a particular radio station. And that's what he wanted to do and build his career there, until he met an officer at the border that told him, hey, what are you doing? You can't be doing this. You need to decide where you want to live. You can't live there and work here. You have to make up your mind. Where are you going? So he acted a little bit like the keeper of the gates, or Sharon, and offered my dad had a choice. And he said, well, my family's there, but my work is there. So I'd rather stay with my family. So he made that choice. And it was hard on him because he went from being somebody in Juarez to suddenly becoming a nobody in El Paso. He started being a dishwasher. He didn't know the language. He didn't know the culture. He tried his best. And then he had five children in quick succession. So he had to work very hard to give us the kind of life we needed. So he was an illegal alien for a while, undocumented, until my mom helped him get at least a green card for him to be able to stay and work in this country.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with playwright and author Octavio Solis about his book of stories based on his own life, Retablos, Stories from a Life Lived Along the Border. He grew up in El Paso, Texas. Your relationship with your father is something that you describe in the book in a number of different stories, wonderful stories. Tell us first about your relationship with your dad as you were growing up, and then tell us about when you got your first job in the same place where he worked.
Well, my relationship with my father at the beginning was always a little strained. He was working so hard. He had a lot of stress and a lot of pressures, and like a lot of men who are raising a family too young, he felt caged and troubled, and so he blocked himself off from us sometimes without even knowing that he was doing that. He was a kind and loving dad, but he could also, by turns, be sullen and violent. But he stayed with us. He stayed by my mom. He did his best for us. And over time, he started to mellow. But I think I carried a lot of resentment in my heart for all those years, all that time. And it took its toll. I think in many of my plays, I'm chiefly a playwright, by the way, in many of my plays, I tried to work out that relationship with the father. Who's the father? And can we go beyond the point where we see him as a monster to find the man? And I didn't realize much about what I didn't understand what he was going through much until I became a father, until I had my daughter. And then things started to change for me, and I started understanding him and started realizing how closed off I had been from him. But Latino families typically have a tough time dealing with the father. The father is often remote and distant and may seem cold, but it's because he's troubled. He's troubled by the choices that he has to contend with, the world he has to contend with in order to put food on our table.
Well, exactly. You know, you're telling, on the one hand, you're telling a story that is universal in many ways. You know, difficult relationships between fathers and sons are in every culture. But in this book, in Retablos, Stories from a Life Lived Along the Border, it's also very much tied to the circumstances that your family was in. So it's very particular to that as well. So tell us, now, you know, your father came from Mexico. He struggled with, you know, his identity as a person here. You grew up as an American citizen because you were born here. Was that part of the tension between the two of you as well?
Well, I wish I could say that were so. I don't think it was as much that, because he quickly... Later in the 80s, he became an American citizen, both he and my mom. My mom had residence alien status until she became a citizen. But with my dad, it was more that I always felt like he yearned to be back in Mexico. Like there was a part of him that still yearned for that old country where he could be, I think, freer, where he could be a person of some standing, or at least have a better, an equal chance. But that started fading over time as he started to love and enjoy the life he had here. Maybe I'm reading too much into him, and I'm sure he can speak for himself. But that's what I sensed from him. And I desperately wanted to be American, and only that. I desperately wanted to shun the things that made me more Mexican, because in my education, all the people of note, all the people of some success were white. And as I studied literature and I decided to become a writer, especially as I got into theater, I started noticing that all the people that we studied ranged from Shakespeare to Moliere to Chekhov to Arthur Miller to Eugene O'Neill and Tennessee Williams and Sam Shepard, but none of them looked like me. So in the end, I felt like I was studying to be a dead white man in some regard. And so I think the issues were less with him and more with me in terms of identity. I put the gulf between him and me.
I'd like to come back to what you just said, but just to linger a little bit longer on your family. It also reflected a kind of wall that developed between you and your brother as well. And you know, this borders, walls, these are very connected in the reality and the imagination of our country at this point.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, talk about those connections, both the walls within the family, within family members, and the walls that have been increasingly erected on our border and that reflect the national psychology or even psychosis.
Yes, I can't help but see comparisons between the two, between the walls we erect in our household and in our own hearts, and those that are consciously, physically being erected on our borders. And one very early on in our family was erected between my brother and I. We had a huge rift when we were hardly teenagers, when we hardly knew what we were doing, we hardly knew who we were, and we felt so alienated from each other that it got to be easier to not deal, to pretend they weren't there, to not see each other. And that seemed like the only way we could really function in the house. So in one of my retablos, I describe how everywhere we walked, everywhere we passed each other, everywhere we, in whatever room we were in our own home, there was this invisible wall there that prevented us from dealing and coping with each other, from talking with each other. And it was convenient. We could use it because then we could relax and pretend like, you know, like there wasn't anything wrong. But later on, he made an effort to break it down, and this started up being a long cooling off period. I think a warming period where we started sort of finally addressing each other, and then I put it in this book. I put that event and the rift between my brother, I put in the story, and who knows, I think I may have inadvertently erected the wall again.
Oh, that's so sad, because I wanted to know what happened.
Well, he congratulated me first on the book, and then I heard that he was very deeply upset by it. But, you know, I kind of felt that I did it out of love. I did it out of love for him. I wrote the book out of love for my parents as well. And I tried to attempt to offer these stories with presenting some grace without ignoring the ugliness that happens in all families, but presented with some sort of grace and real love and admiration for everyone in my family. But it, you know, sometimes it's out of my hands. The other thing I felt as I looked through the book is I felt like if there was anyone who was being put under the microscope and who was being exposed, it was me. I was the one who, to whom I think I was really, I don't quite know how to put it, but I think these stories were not about them, as they were more about me and the transgressions I made, the reparations I have tried to make, and the lessons I've learned from those experiences.
And I think that comes across very strongly in this book. And of course, you know, families, it's different. People have long histories. It's hard. You can't really control how they're going to take your take on things. But I think that certainly comes across to the reader. And there's a very poignant moment in the book where your father owns up to perhaps what he felt even more strongly than you might have felt, what were his failings as a father. And there is a beautiful, you know, note of love and realness there. As describe to us what happened, that incident.
Well, it was the retablo refers to a moment where the gulf is just too wide between my father and me, and he knows it, and he's doing his best to try to come outside and offer some healing. I mean, he just doesn't have the equipment for that. He doesn't know how to do that. He doesn't know how to say I'm sorry. And it's chiefly about that. While in their backyard, where there's a small church, there's a church bazaar going on, where they're playing the game of loteria, which is a kind of Mexican bingo, played with pinto beans on these cards with these really archetypal images, and a caller who calls out these images, these names, and these titles of the images on the cards. And there seems to be a kind of a merging between that loteria game and what's going on in the silence between my father and I. And he doesn't know what to say. He doesn't know what to say except that he says the word era cabrón, which says basically I was a jerk. That's all he can say. And he can't even finish his beer. He sets it down. And he goes inside, and it's a long, painful moment between us, and then a long, painful moment afterwards with me alone, just with those words hanging in the air and that beer before me. And I feel like the only thing I can do is take a drink of his beer. And when I do that, I feel like, well, now we're drinking out of the same spigot, so to speak. So I felt like that was in many ways the first step in breaking down the walls between my father and me. It's also, to me, it seemed like the very first inkling of real change in my father. Dramatic change in him. Night and day, he changed. And he's a very, very different man now. But, you know, that's the thing about these stories that I realized in describing events that happened 30, 40, 50 years ago. And that's that we never step into the same river twice. The father I knew then is not the father now, and he's not the same man from day to day. We're always changing. We're always going through changes. If we don't change, then really we may as well be dead. And so that was the realization that sort of hit me when I was working on these retablos, in particular in dealing with stories that involved my father.
Yes. I mean, you talk about how memory is transformed into story through a memoir, that's a transformation. And, you know, as you said, people aren't the same. You don't step in the same river twice. You don't even do that with yourself. I mean, you are a different person now than the boy who was experiencing those things. So, you know, as a playwright, you're also telling stories. What connection do you make in the process of having written this memoir in the form that it is, and the plays that you've written? What are the connections between the transformation of memory into story?
Well, one of the things that I found very useful, there's a tool, because I've never written fiction before. I've only just started branching out of my theater sphere into the world of literature, and with some success, I might add. But the thing that helped me is, because I've never taken a fiction writing class in my life, and though I'm an avid reader and I love prose, the short story form, as well as the fiction form, I felt very ill-equipped to do it, and yet I felt I had these stories. So the tool that I found very useful for me that helped me was the first-person voice. The voice in the first-person present tense voice was very useful for me with retablos, because in essence, I'm writing monologues. I'm writing monologues for a single character to tell, a single person standing up before a microphone or around a campfire telling stories about himself, in which he plays all the characters and can describe the events from inside as well as from outside. And so I thought, well, that's the theater monologue, the soliloquy is a great and useful tool in the theater, but I think it was my way also into these stories. It really enabled me to delve into them. The other thing that I was going to say about memory is it became my muse. It allowed me to fictionalize what I could not remember. Because I'm writing about events that took place 50 years ago, and even though this very specific event is etched in my mind, every time I revisit it, it changes. It shifts in little ways. I remember new things, but I don't know if I actually remember them or if I invented them. That's how memory works. It's faulty, but in its inaccuracy, it's useful, because then it gives us permission to be a storyteller, to be a writer, for those patches that are blank, we can fill them in with invention, with things that feel like, oh, this will be good for the story. This will add to the story. So I gave myself permission to do that and collaborated with this muse, with memory, to help recreate these moments in a way that made them both present and alive, but also made them feel like fiction. Like the ultimate goal is to tell a story and not to describe something historically accurate about myself, because I think that's not as interesting.
Well, that's a wonderful answer. You know, in just a few minutes that we have left, I can't leave without giving some reference and question to our current situation, where the border is a scene of really unimaginable human suffering and cruelty on the part of the U.S. government. So after having read this book, written this book, Stories from a Life Lived Along the Border, and looking at the situation today, what are some thoughts that you can leave us with?
Well, in the introduction, I wrote that the crap on the border never changes. That there will always be somebody who wants to come here, and there will always be somebody who wants to keep them back there, there being Mexico or wherever. And I said it never changes. It'll always be this way. But actually, I was wrong. It's gotten worse. It's gotten so much worse. And it's become a flashpoint, a national flashpoint. And especially my town of El Paso, where I was born and raised. That situation has become just really dire. And I feel like it's incumbent on me to take a stand. Where before I felt like, just tell more personal stories about myself. That's all that needs to be done. And I don't think of myself as a political writer. I feel now like I can't. We have to take a stand. We have to take a stand before something more, before our government does and takes more draconian measures. I can't help but think of Germany at a time when people could have stood up and could have said no to the National Socialist movement that was going on there, and then decided, no, you know what, the economy's good. As long as the economy's good, why should we complain? Yeah, okay, it's unpleasant, but, you know, we're making more money. And I feel like we're almost at that point. And so I feel like we have to speak up. We have to take a stand. And if my book is used as a way to sort of educate people about the situation in the border, I welcome that. Eagerly, I welcome it. I have a play running right now called Mother Road here at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival in Ashland, Oregon, that is addressing many of these issues. And I have a new play called Quijote Nuevo, which we produced at California Shakespeare Theater in Berkeley last year, and which is going to be opening in September at Hartford Stage in Connecticut, that also deals with border issues. I have always been writing about the border and never really truly owned it. and yet now it seems like my work is suddenly more relevant than I ever thought it would be because of this. And I wish, in many ways, I wish it weren't. I wish we didn't have this horrible situation to put the spotlight on my work. But it means then that my work can put the spotlight on that issue. Then I feel a lot better about that.
And I think it does precisely because it tells these personal stories within that context, which is what people need to be able to transcend borders, is to understand the common humanity that we all share.
It's all about empathy. It's all about empathy and not seeing people as these foreign bodies or as vermin or as drug dealers and rapists and people that are here simply to get a free ride or to steal your job. It's really a lot. It's really about seeing them as simply people who want a better chance, who just want to be given a better chance to make a life for their families. And yeah, you know what? I can sort of see the point of view about their about fairness, get in line, you know, do it the legal way, get in line. But these people have nothing. They come from countries that have persecuted them. They come from extreme poverty. They come from atrocities and from failed governments. And they have nothing. And that's why they're here. And to make them wait in line? What line? And for how long? They don't have jobs. They don't have food. They don't have basic needs. And so they're coming here to America, to this country, because it's that beacon of hope.
And for those who know something about the history, understand also that the conditions of their countries in many ways stem from policies of the United States.
Oh, yes.
So we have an obligation.
Yes, I think people forget that, or I think there's a generation that doesn't even know that the U.S. sponsored, exacerbated, and extended wars in Central America, in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, that basically destroyed those countries and took out their infrastructure. There's nothing there. There's nothing there but poverty and the usurpation by gangs and a government that just is inadequate in providing basic needs and infrastructure for these people. So they come here looking for that chance. Why do they bypass Mexico? Because Mexico doesn't offer that same beacon of hope that this country has always offered. And if we turn off that beacon, I think we cast ourselves in darkness.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. Octavio Solis, it has just been really wonderful to talk with you about your wonderful book.
Oh, thank you very much.
Retablos. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Francesca, it's been my pleasure.
playwright and author Octavio Solis. I spoke with him about his book Retablos in June, but after the mass shooting in El Paso, August 3rd, I called him to get his thoughts about that assault in his hometown. Stay tuned for that after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. In our first segment today, we aired my interview with playwright and author Octavio Solis about his book Retablos, Stories from a Life Lived Along the Border. We recorded that interview in June. On August 3rd, a gunman opened fire in a Walmart in El Paso, killing 22 people and wounding 24 others. I reached out to Octavio Solis to ask him about his thoughts on that shooting, starting with when he first heard about it.
Well, I was appalled. I was appalled. My parents shop at that Walmart. They were on their way to buy groceries there, but then decided at the last minute to go to my sister's house instead and visit there and then pick up the groceries on the way home. So they had no inkling that this had happened. And they still don't know quite how to process it. My dad's in his 80s, my mom's in her late 70s. And so they're trying to wrap their heads around it. Everyone else in El Paso is also reeling because they don't know what they did to deserve this. We're all kind of reeling from this.
Wow. First of all, that's just horrendous. I'm so glad your family did manage to, escape with a close call.
Yes. And, it's one thing to have a mass shooting happen in El Paso. They've happened everywhere. They happened up here near where I live in Roseburg. But a mass shooting with racial overtones, casts a very, very different light on the violence. It's more particular and more insidious, and it strikes fear not just in everybody, but especially in Latinos in this country. People who are brown in this country feel utterly targeted.
Right. And so when you say they wonder what they did to deserve this, it seems a striking phrase that people are internalizing. Is that part of what happens, that the sense of being hunted also comes with questions about their place in this country?
Yes, because El Pasoans they're not like Antifa. They're not going to go out and riot and throw Molotov cocktails in the street. They're not going to be occupying the downtown section of El Paso and make their voices heard in that way. It's just not in the character of the people. The people are humble. They're living the American dream. They want to work. They want to get along. They've always done what is right in order to be Americans in this country. And they're just more chill. So they're surprised that this violence has happened. Not only that, but El Paso is a military town. Fort Bliss has been there for over 100 years. And families come not only from El Paso itself and the surrounding area, but they come from all over the country to train and live and work there. So it's somewhat, even though politically it's kind of a purple city, it's still very conservative. So there's nothing in the character of El Paso that would provoke someone to go out there and start a war.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with playwright and author Octavio Solis. As you may be able to tell from the clarity of the recording up to now, Solis was recording his side of the conversation. But at this point, unbeknownst to him, his recording stopped on its own. Drat. So, for a section, we'll switch to the phone sound I was recording through my iPhone. And in fact, the shooter came from 300 miles away, from Dallas. And what struck me was that he seemed to be under the impression that El Paso was always belonging to the United States, where in fact, while your parents did immigrate from Mexico, many of Mexican families in El Paso have been there for longer than Texas was part of the U.S. Isn't that right?
Well, that's part of the amnesia that I think is both self-imposed and imposed on us. As natives of this land, we're constantly being told that we're foreigners. We were here first. We have this land and have had it for eons. And now we're made to feel like we don't belong here, even though we were here first. The line was set along the Rio Grande, separating El Paso from Juarez, and marking that as a new border between the United States and Mexico. And people who were north of that, if they were brown, they were almost persona non grata as American citizens. They lost rights, they lost land, they lost all the privileges they enjoyed as Mexican citizens, and became second-class citizens in this country. And that was a change that took many, many years for people to get used to. But El Pasoans just want to now, they want to live as American citizens. They want to live here, work here, be here. The other thing I was going to say is Juarez is always, the checkpoints between, and the border between Juarez and El Paso has always been fluid. It's always been fluid. People come from Juarez to come over to El Paso to shop, to dine, to visit family that live here, and vice versa. People from El Paso go to Juarez all the time for their shopping needs, for tanking up their gas, their car with gasoline, for their own dining experience. So the restaurants in Juarez were superior to the ones in El Paso. My parents, when we wanted to go out for a fine dining experience, always went to Juarez.
Octavio Solis told me that fluidity is alarming to some people today. I asked him to explain, and here Solis's own recording begins again.
I think that this young man came to El Paso deliberately. He chose it. He came here, and he chose El Paso for his bloodbath, because he knew and understood that El Paso is the future, that this is a city that is largely Hispanic and gets along with everyone else just fine. And they represent a change that's going to happen in this country in the next 20, 30 years. A lot of this country is going to look more like El Paso than ever. And that scares people. They would rather sort of create an environment of fear and terror that will drive us out so they can continue living in their little dioramas of what they think America should be, in that rarefied museum air, when they know it's really the past. But they're doing everything they can to change it. And it starts with a lone wolf now, yes, but it can grow to become more organized. And that's our fear. President Eisenhower, who's acclaimed as being one of the fine presidents of the 1950s, he started a program of deportation and denaturalization called Operation Wetback. And people have forgotten that because they have short memories about that. But Latinos remember. Mexican Americans remember, and they remember that, and they keep a file in their souls about all the transgressions, all the wrongs that are committed to them. And they weren't like that. You know, many of them came here to escape the Mexican Revolution. 100 years ago, there was a horrible, violent revolution in Mexico. They came here to seek sanctuary and safety from that. And they thought that this was finally it. They've done it. They've been here several generations. Their children's children are now Americans. They fought in the armed services. They've put in their stripes. They've put in their time. And to have all that suddenly taken away, to them seems unjust and very dismaying. So they lose hope. They can lose hope. Eventually, I think they'll find it. We'll find it back again. But right now, there's a spirit of fear that's being inculcated through something like this. And we're counting on our leaders to stand up and say something to repudiate it, but they don't.
Well, that just underscores the need for ordinary people to stand up.
Yep, definitely.
Octavio Solis. He's the author of more than 20 plays and served as a cultural consultant on Pixar's movie, Coco. His book, Retablos, is published by City Lights Press. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from that book. Solis and I ended our call on the note that ordinary people need to step up to support those who are being targeted by hate and by the racist and anti-immigrant policies of the Trump administration. One person who's using his art to combat the hatred is singer-songwriter Don Arbor, who we interviewed in 2018 about his song Welcoming Immigrants, Everyone Comes From Somewhere. He says it honors his own immigrant roots and celebrates the diversity that made America great in the first place. This seems a good time to revisit that interview.
Let me be the first to welcome you.
Sometimes a song says it better than a whole book. California-based singer-songwriter Don Arbor has written topical songs before. His newest is about immigration and keeping America's welcome to immigrants alive. It's called Everyone Comes From Somewhere. And we called Don Arbor up on Skype to talk about it. Don Arbor, your song, Everyone Comes From Somewhere, it's just a beautiful song. And it starts out with, let me be the first to welcome you. It must have been so hard to leave your homeland. I can't begin to understand the trouble you've been through. This really is a compassionate message. Why did you write this song?
I wrote the song to express something positive that would be something of an antidote to the divisiveness that we're hearing from our government. My grandmother, in particular, was an inspiration to me. She came from Eastern Europe when she was 15, speaking no English in the hold of a steamship, moved to Lower Manhattan, eventually settled in New Jersey on a small farm that later became a suburb where I grew up. She was a really inspiring figure to me because she became an American citizen. She gave me great opportunities that I've been able to experience through my lifetime that wouldn't have occurred if she hadn't had the courage to do what she did, and also if the doors to our country hadn't been so open. So it seems arbitrary to me that we would close the doors now. And Everyone Comes From Somewhere is my way of saying we have a lot more in common than we have that divides us. And it just makes me heartsick to see the divisiveness that we are experiencing around us. So this is kind of my personal antidote.
So it sounds like your own family echoes a lot of my own. As you point out, well, probably your grandmother came around the turn of the 20th century. Is that right?
1905.
That was exactly the year that some of my grandparents came as well. You know, it was a time where the gate was open, and I think a lot of people don't realize just how much it has closed now. Do you know something of how immigration or what immigration was like when your grandmother came?
I have tried to learn as much as I can about the waves of immigrants, and what I've learned is that there has always been a tension between the ideal of an open society that creates this melting pot of different cultures on the one hand, and resistance to immigration on the other hand. I know, for example, in the mid-19th century, waves of Irish immigrants were subjected to quite a bit of discrimination. But now, of course, we have Irish folks at the highest levels of government, and like John Kelly, who's now the enforcer against immigration as chief of staff, is descended from Irish immigrants who themselves were subject to discrimination. I think that in the early 20th century, the door was quite open to the immigrants from Eastern Europe, although, of course, they didn't speak the language and tended to settle in communities where they had other immigrants living all around them. But as they assimilated into the culture, they've become part of that great fabric of society that we know as the United States.
In this song, Everyone Comes From Somewhere, you ask, is this the end of the line for the land of liberty? Talk about that line.
The lines that come before it have to do with hearing people say, we don't want your poor, got no use for them no more. No huddled masses yearning to be free, which of course I've borrowed from the Statue of Liberty. And the question is, are we going to keep to the ideals? And it's a serious question when you look around at what's happened with our 45th president. I think that that tension I was talking about a couple of minutes ago is something that's easily exploited. We all are capable of what Lincoln called the better angels of our nature, or the demons, that would be the flip side. And once you start stimulating those demons, they're very hard to put back into a less outrageous state. I was going to say back into the bottle, but it's not really like a genie. It's kind of the opposite of a genie. So is it the end of the line for the land of liberty? My answer is no. I think we can keep the doors open, keep the lights of liberty shining, but I don't think it's a sure thing. I think we must be vigilant. We can't just assume that the values we grew up with will always stand. Every generation has to fight for them, and that's how I feel now. We're currently in a fight to maintain the ideals that this country was founded on.
And so if somebody wants to go watch the music video, because we have to say it's not just a song but a video as well, where will they go?
They can find it on YouTube by searching Don Arbor, or Facebook Don Arbor, or my own website, www.donarbor.com, which has a link to the video and also some other songs and videos that I've made over the years.
Well, Don Arbor, thank you so much for talking with us here on WPKN. The song is Everyone Comes From Somewhere, and we're going to be playing it right now.
Well, thanks for having me.
Let me be the first to welcome you. It must have been so hard to leave your homeland. I can't begin to understand the trouble you've been through. Just let me be the first to welcome you. Many dreamers came this way before. Broken line, and each one hoped to find the peace and freedom they were longing for. And everyone comes from somewhere, everyone comes from somewhere, whether near or far. I am the son of a son. Sailed across the sea, escaping from the wars. They were welcome to our shores. I won't be the one to close the doors. 'Cause everyone comes from somewhere. Everyone comes from somewhere. Whether near or far. She is the great, 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 great. got no use for them no more. No huddled masses yearning to be free. Is this the end of the line for the land of liberty? No, no, everyone comes from somewhere. Everyone comes from somewhere.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.